Tuasi. Tuasia 107.
Hello, this is The Wire coming to you from 4EB in Brisbane. Today, illegal fishing on the Galapagos spurs citizens to action.
It is very important that we preserve these sort of sites. Not only Galapagos, there are protected areas all over the world, and these are the sort of temples.
Queensland Greens announce a $60 billion housing plan. Mysterious footprints on Crete leave researchers scratching their heads. And we ask, could microfinance ever take off in Australia?
It's a complicated question because I think we like to think that we are more community-minded than we actually are in reality. So what they've found, and they have had microfinance in developed countries, and they haven't found a great deal of traction using just social collateral.
All of that and more, independent current affairs, coming up for you soon. Thanks for tuning in and welcome. My name is Stephen Regal. Well, last week, a Chinese fishing trawler caught operating illegally close to the Galapagos Islands was captured with more than 6,000 sharks and protected species on board. The story went viral online, and now many Ecuadorians are calling on their government to take action. Eduardo Jordan investigates.
The Galapagos Islands are an archipelago around 900 kilometers west of Ecuador, and is one of the 24 provinces that make up the South American country. The islands are a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Naturalist guide from the Galapagos National Park, Daniela Cox, says the trawler contained protected species.
So 300 tons of different species were found that night, and between the most important ones were the hammerhead sharks, Spherina lewini. That's the main species that we are very concerned about because it's in the list of UICN already as a potential species in danger of extinction. Also, they found silky sharks, which are in less importance of threat. However, they are migratory species, and other type of fish like yellowfin tuna as well.
The Chinese fishing trawler was caught illegally fishing around the exclusive economic zone of the Galapagos Islands and was fined $5 million, with several of its crew facing jail sentences. Griffith University PhD candidate Andres Pazmiño is researching strategic planning of protected areas and is from the Galapagos Islands. He says the charges sets a precedent in Ecuador.
The sentence obviously sets a precedent of how the newly enacted Galapagos Special Regime Law in 2015 and the new constitution of 2008 can be implemented. So it is very important in the sense that this sets a precedent of how the law can be interpreted and how judges can sentence this sort of environmental crime.
The Ecuadorian law provides rights to the environment, and these were reinforced in court.
The Galapagos Islands are a special regime in Ecuador. They are not governed as any other provinces. The Galapagos Islands are a province, one of the 24 provinces of Ecuador, but governed under a special regime for conservation purposes. The Galapagos Islands are also a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So there's a lot of overlapping laws that protect Galapagos from local, provincial, national, and international levels. So the biodiversity in the Galapagos is protected. Additionally, the Constitution of Ecuador recognizes the rights of nature to exist, to evolve, and to maintain its ecological processes. So those are the facts that led the sentence, because this was considered as an environmental crime.
Although it's not the first time this has happened, it's the first time it's become viral. Social media and the internet helped to raise the issue internationally.
There are so many factors that could have influenced this. Galapagos didn't have access to a good internet, a good communication until mid-2005, more or less, when we had access to broadband. So it was very hard for people to communicate these sort of things. Also, the constitution recognizing the rights of nature just was enacted in 2008. and the new Galapagos Special Regime Law, which seeks the conservation of the Galapagos socio-ecological system, was passed in 2015. So it can be because of all these factors combined, or a combination of all these factors.
Ms. Cox says the Galapagos community is waiting for the Ecuadorian government to explain how they will protect the area from future illegal fishing.
The Galapagos community is really looking after the response from the Ecuadorian Navy in terms of the sovereignty and the protection, not only the marine reserve, of course, but also these 180 miles around the Ecuadorian territory, which is the exclusive zone for economics, which is near the Galapagos Islands, and it's the one which allows the Ecuadorian boats to come and fish, but not international.
She says while the incident may show the limits of government power, people power has grown in the process.
We have to consider this topic of Galapagos is just an example of what's going on worldwide by the fact that citizens are the ones becoming more empowered and not just waiting the response directly from the state, even though, of course, it's the obligation from the states to say, hey, this is what we are doing because this is our responsibility. But on the other hand, I completely believe it's a positive impact in the sense that the authorities will have to respond in a quicker way, in a more efficient way about the different obligations they have with the communities.
That story was by Eduardo Jordan. At least 20,000 people currently are homeless in Queensland, and the Queensland Greens have announced a plan to tackle the problem. Their plan is a $60 billion package to address homelessness and housing affordability, with an aim to fund it through a tax on rental revenue and mining royalties. Amy McMahon, Greens candidate for South Brisbane, spoke to Danielle Daly about their plan.
At least 20,000 people currently are homeless in Queensland, and the Greens have announced a plan to tackle the problem. The Queensland Greens have announced a $60 billion package to address homelessness and housing affordability, with an aim to fund the program through a tax on rental revenue and mining royalties. Amy McMahon, Greens candidate for South Brisbane, spoke to Danielle Daly about their plan.
We know in Queensland at the moment we're facing a housing crisis. There's 20,000 people who are homeless, there's about 30,000 people on the waiting list for social housing, and about one in five Queenslanders are facing some degree of housing stress with either unaffordable rents or unaffordable mortgages. What we're arguing is that we need some significant government investment to make sure that every Queenslander has access to a safe and affordable home.
And you said the main way you're going to fund this is by taxing the revenue of rental income and properties that are left empty, not the profits. Will that increase rents?
The housing scheme will eventually pay itself off with the rental revenue from these affordable homes. So it shouldn't have a significant impact on the private rental market. In fact, if anything, it should be levelling out rent. The scheme will be funded through a combination of rental revenue from affordable housing as they come online, a vacancy tax, royalties from mining and government bonds.
And will this include properties such as holiday homes?
I would imagine so.
Shelter New South Wales considers that the public housing there costs $220,000 per dwelling, plus another $166,000 for the land. Now, obviously, land is cheaper in Queensland, but for an average construction worker's wage, hire 16,000 of those, that would be $832 million a year, plus $4.4 billion just for the dwelling on the $220,000 mark. That would only leave $770 million for the land costs, 20,000 properties a year. That's only $38,500. Considering you want to build medium-density housing, how are you going to afford this?
A big proportion of this is coming from we've got really good interest rates at the moment, which we believe government should be taking advantage of. And, you know, debt-driven investment in these kind of productive assets is kind of essential infrastructure that we need in Queensland, a good path to go down. We know that many other countries in the world have similar kinds of high investment in social housing. And
why are you going for medium-density housing rather than, say, units and flats?
Medium density housing means we can be fitting a significant number of people into places that people want to live in the southeast corner and other parts of Queensland, being able to look at those areas where there's high growth and be able to fit, you know, a large proportion of people in a sustainable way.
Is a factor that medium density housing requires more land being factored into the costings of the policy?
So the land that we'll be using for this policy will be either publicly available land or urban infill. So it won't be any green fields development. The aim is to be looking at this urban infill approach to find patches of land, be buying up private property as they come online so that we can fit people into these urban corners.
Adam Barnes, manager of the Sustaining Young Tenancies Project at Brisbane Youth Service, says while providing affordable housing is an important step to reduce homelessness, there also needs to be targeted support for young people who are most at risk.
It's important for young people that we realise that there's some different pathways into homelessness for them. For some young people, they come to homelessness through family breakdown, so it might be conflict occurring at home. And for others, there's family violence occurring at home. And for all young people, affordability is going to be an issue. I think absolutely providing more affordable housing is a fantastic place to start to address homelessness for young people. We then need to consider the particular needs of young people to be able to sustain their housing. And for young people, those needs are going to vary. I mean, an investment in terms of support to help them to transition into adulthood. Preventative measures in the homelessness space, particularly for young people, are incredibly important. We know that young people often become homeless through family violence, and we know that their pathways to homelessness are gradual.
That story by Danielle Daly.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Many families in third world nations rely on microfinance to make ends meet, but in Australia, the system has yet to reach many people. The system of small loans, typically given to poor people to start businesses, now reaches hundreds of millions around the world. The most well-known institution is the Grameen Bank, which started in Bangladesh in 1976 and now operates in 58 countries, including Australia. But not everyone thinks this model of finance works as well in developed nations.
In the developing world, what we find is microfinance interest rates are around 30% per year, which when they're used for business is no problem generally for people to repay over the course of a year. It's a bit of a problem when it's for consumption, because then if you think about it in the Australian context, if someone needs to borrow $100 to buy a refrigerator, they're going to have to repay $130 at the end of the year. So that person is individually worse off.
Dr. Catherine Hunt, lecturer in accounting, finance and economics at Griffith University. Dr. Hunt says there is a great deal of difference between microfinance loans given out here and abroad.
In the Australian context, we're talking less than $4,000 generally for personal needs, or less than $20,000 for business needs. But in the world in general, it's usually more like $100 or $200.
The way the finance is built up is usually different too. Robert Dunn is the CEO of Opportunity International Australia, a microfinance organisation providing loans to people in developing countries.
We work through local partners in those countries. They're the experts. They're the people who know the local situation. And we come alongside those local partners, somebody we have influence over. The funds we provide to them are raised in Australia by generous supporters as tax-deductible donations.
Mr. Dunn says these loans often start small and get bigger over time.
With that money to typically a woman, she will either expand an existing business or set up a business. So the typical microfinance, buy a second-hand sewing machine and make clothes, is absolutely what happens. With a subsequent loan, each loan is larger, she might be able to afford a cow and be able to milk the cow and sell the milk. So it's a little business like that.
Opportunity International Australia boasts a 99% repayment rate on its loans. Grameen Bank publicises a similar level of adherence. Dr. Hunt says part of what makes the model work is its reliance on the input of other community members.
In developing countries in particular, most of those countries are what we call a collectivist society, which means that the social bonds within those communities are extremely important to people. And keeping those social bonds is more important than anything else. So what that means is that if you've had people vouch for you, five people in your community say, yes, Catherine is a good woman and she will repay her loan, I would lose so much faith by defaulting on that loan that it's not worth it to me to default.
Mr. Dunn says the arrangement works like a support network.
When they start in this process, they have no credit history. So this is very much unsecured personal finance to someone with no credit history and no collateral. But what they will do is they will come typically with four friends. And the five ladies who trust each other will co-guarantee each other's loan. So where there's, a fortnightly repayment, not every fortnight everybody will have the money to do it. It's not like they have a regular income stream. And so their friends will put the money up for them, but they will fix up their friends later on and pay them back. So this is a support network.
So could this work here?
It's a complicated question because I think we like to think that we are more community-minded than we actually are in reality. So what they've found, and they have had microfinance in developed countries for quite a while as well in some form or another, and they haven't found a great deal of traction using just social collateral. So they've either used a charity model in which there's no collateral, or else if it is references that are required, then it needs to be from someone kind of a higher position in the society.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
For years, advocates of mental health have battled to reduce stigma, create open conversations, and secure legitimate medical treatments for mental illnesses. Though the fight is ongoing, clear progress has been made as more people are aware and actively seeking help for their illnesses than ever before. Bridget Sloan reports.
In the 2017 federal budget, the Australian government made a commitment to fund programs that meet the demand for mental health services with low-intensity treatments for people suffering from mild to moderate illness. Federal member for Ford, Bert van Manen, is thrilled to see two new centres providing this kind of treatment in his electorate.
What I really like about this new program is that we're trying to identify and assist people before their mental health concerns become a really big issue and we have to deal with some more severe situations.
Mr. Van Manen says this program is a positive step forward as it aims to provide resources online and over the phone without a specialist present.
There's a range of initiatives being undertaken and I think $4.2 billion being invested in mental health services across the country. So I think we're certainly heading in the right direction.
Dr. Sebastian Rosenberg, a senior lecturer on mental health policy from the University of Sydney, identifies the urgency of these new services.
Unless there are alternatives after inquiry, that basically stops this that our mental spiral, system is then crisis. We are our system is out of balance. Doomed is the, to the simply gap replicate in our service current system between those two situations. We really have failed to develop the suite of programs and community-based mental health services that are necessary. Unless there are alternatives that can stop this spiral, we are, I think, doomed to simply replicate our current crisis situation.
Dr. Rosenberg does praise low-intensity services, however, as an essential part of a new approach to mental health treatment.
So that's where, you know, new programs like low-intensity services and other things are quite exciting, because even if they may be small, they are adding to our armory of potential service response to mental illness and starting to fill the gap which exists, fill the void. I think consumers are now, they're not waiting for face-to-face appointments at times that are convenient for Australian health professionals to see them. They are jumping online and receiving useful online services from Belgium. And this is a revolution And I think that Australia is in real danger of missing out.
But as useful as these new resources may be, doctors say that they should not be seen as a replacement for traditional mental health services. Associate Professor Nicola Reevely says low-intensity treatments can be seen as the missing step in a process of mental health recovery.
What's going to be increasingly happening in Australia, because it's also happening in other countries, so when you first present to a health professional, for example, with mild or moderate depression and anxiety, the idea is first of all refer you to a low intensity treatment, and then you try that for a while and you see if that helps you. If it doesn't, then perhaps you need to step up to a more intensive treatment.
Those suffering from mental health would be aware that there is no quick fix, but Associate Professor Reevely says these services may not work for everyone.
In terms of the treatments themselves, they can be effective, people with mild to moderate conditions. The issue perhaps with some people is that it's not perhaps very motivating. So what you tend to find is the dropout rates are quite high.
And Bridget Sloan had that story. A recent study published in the Proceedings of the Geologists Association found human-like footprints dating back 5.7 million years ago in Western Crete in Greece. Antopeda spoke to Kira Westaway from Macquarie University about the findings in this study.
This is really interesting. These are the oldest footprints of hominids that we know, so obviously a lot older than the Laetoli footprints that we found in Africa. And what's interesting about this study is that it certainly looks like they are from hominins. The authors have been a little bit reserved about what they were actually calling the species. It could well be a very an unknown ape species that we don't really know much about that happened to have very human-like feet,
yes.
Which is something we call a convergence of evolution. So it's traits that are very similar to ours. But the thing is about this is that the traits are very, very similar. So say like if you were comparing two animals that were quite similar, for example, like a shark or a dolphin, you would see similarities, but you'd also see differences. And at the moment, the authors are really finding trouble trying to see the differences. So, you know, the sort of more parsimonious explanation is that perhaps they were from known hominids at the time. So there's three hominids that they know of around the age that they've associated with these footprints. So it may well be that these footprints were made by these hominids. But the difficulty is that with these hominids that we know, that we don't often have evidence of their feet. So we can't, you know, sort of get the bones of their feet and compare it with the footprints that we find. So without that skeletal evidence, without that bone evidence, it's really hard to kind of associate the footprints with one of the hominins that we know.
Dr. Kira Westaway says that the findings do not challenge conventional theories on human evolution, but shows us that early hominids might have migrated out of Africa earlier than we thought.
Some people have sort of argued that it could challenge that Africa was the cradle of humanity. But I think that finding an early hominin outside of Africa doesn't necessarily mean that was the cradle of humanity. Do you know what I mean? So
yes,
I don't think
I agree with that.
It's not really calling for a shift across to the Mediterranean, which is somewhere that most people would never put the cradle of humanity. But I think it's more like it's showing that it's probably challenging the first hominins that actually left Africa. So we have an accepted idea that Homo erectus was the first to leave Africa. And evidence of early homs like this outside of Africa definitely shows us that perhaps they weren't the first to leave and that perhaps these early hominins migrated out of Africa much earlier. And this kind of area was like their homelands. It wasn't just, you know, they evolved in one place or the other. They just kind of evolved and moved around outside and back into Africa over those long periods.
Dr. Westaway says more work needs to be done to assign a species to the footprint.
I think that to really gain traction, this research would benefit from some direct dating of the footprints. But, you know, directly dating a footprint, it can be very challenging. So they've done well to get the relative dating within that sedimentary layer. And then obviously the classification of which species of hominin they think it actually is. That's hard. And I think they've rightly been quite hesitant about which species to attribute this to, mainly because obviously at that period of time, we don't have all the skeletal evidence that can be compared to the actual footprint itself. So trying to assign which one was the track maker, as they call it in the paper, can be quite a challenge. So I think they've done well to be a little bit hesitant about that.
Dr. Kira Westaway, ending that story by Anto Peter. That's The Wire for today. Great to have you with us, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between Radio Adelaide, Sydney's 2SER, and 4EB in Brisbane, and we're produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Just tune in weekdays, same time, on your local community radio station to hear us again. And if you'd like to check out any of the stories you heard here today, go to thewire.org.au. While you're online, check us out on Twitter, The Wire Radio, all one word, and Facebook, The Wire, independent current affairs on community radio. Today's program came to you from our studios here in Brisbane from 4EB. My name's Stephen Rigol. Thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.
It's not just about people in barrels, so shut up.
What the hell?
Plenty of interesting banter to offer up right here on 2SER.
The system will defeat itself. Nothing stays in a steady state. It overheats and melts. It only feeds itself. The system, yo, I think it exists. Just because, like a pit eats his pups, eats his own litter up. The system's fucked, it's corrupt. It's for his own survival, it's genocidal. No place of origin, no beginning cycle. Let's occupy all streets. It's crazy to think in the 80s I wanted minks in the bins to listen to Michael and Grand Poop or Maxwell and get cash while I'm sipping on drinks and Nike sweatsuits and Gucci links. I'm like a Russian mob figure, I'm mad low in the shadows, pick up the shadow. The DJ shadow arose to throw blows. Can't see me, but Nas moving the fastest. I'm a 3D movie, no need of glasses.
I'm a 3D movie, no need of glasses.
Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Close your eyes, cover your ears, do not listen. Try to feel what I'm saying. To make you feel is my new expression. Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Close your eyes, cover your ears, do not listen. Try to feel what I'm saying. To make you feel is my new expression. Systematic. Systematic. I wish I was an arms dealer to sell legal arms in the hood. No backup check, put cash in my palms and we good. Lack of respect, get you to fall where you stood. Mathematics is God language, it's in my blood. Art, music, letters and numbers. I'm a vessel, I'm humble. Meeting startups, I invest if I want to. Transforming global markets with all of my partners. Methodical corporate culture, straight out the projects. What's the ingredients to the realest? Place 2 cups of cranberry in the skillet. A half a cup of water, add some Henny. Let it cook for 8 minutes, but you ain't finished. Let it simmer to the cranberry, pop a little. Keep stirring, sipping this art like Keith Haring. It gets in your blood, you start to feel what I'm feeling.
Don't listen, just try to feel what I'm feeling.
Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Close your eyes, cover your ears, do not listen. Try to feel what I'm saying. To make you feel is my new expression. Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Close your eyes, cover your ears, do not listen. Try to feel what I'm saying. To make you feel is my new expression. Systematic. Systematic.
Cherish the present and work for tomorrow. The time is now. Time is now.
Sydney Fringe 2017 is set to light up the streets again with the opening party, Fringe Ignite, this Saturday. Taking over Sydney's Kensington Street precinct in Chippendale, there'll be music, performance, spoken word, and best of all, it's completely free. Curated by the soulful and electric Nyree, come on down and feel the groove. 2SER is a proud media partner of Sydney Fringe Festival.